Thank you, Nick. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. As it will be immediately apparent to you, I'm an immigrant myself. I'm not sure this acoustic system is really working very well, but it's not going to get much help from me. So if you don't understand what I'm saying, gesticulate in some socially acceptable way, and I will redouble my efforts to assimilate acoustically. As you all know, immigrants do the dirty job that Americans won't do, and here I am. To begin at the end, we're talking about what is an American. My answer to that is that Americans just are. They are Americans. We're told that this is a nation of immigrants. I say it's a nation. Immigration is just not as central to the American experience as a lot of romantic intellectuals would like you to think. It is true, as Nick just said, that the book I wrote, Alienation, just exactly 10 years ago, although it wasn't the first book on immigration, it was perhaps the most noticed up to that point, which is to say, denounced. The only useful thing I learned at the Stanford Graduate School of Business is the definition of a pioneer, a man on a covered wagon with an arrow in his back. Since then, of course, there have been, after a prudent interval, a number of books on the subject. Michelle Malkin, excellent books, I should say, Pat Buchanan, Sam Huntington, and of course, Professor Hansen, who spoke last night. I can't say I've received an enormous amount of credit for this, which is sort of mildly irritating. My late wife, who some of you may remember, found it extremely irritating. But it is typical of the way that ideas slowly enter mainstream discourse. In 1981 and 1982, I wrote an editorial for Barron's called The Man in the Iron Mask, which is what I jokingly said the Reagan administration had done to one of its White House staffers, Peter Ferreira, who had dared to mention the idea of prioritizing Social Security. That was 20-odd years ago. By my count, we should see serious immigration reform in this country, by which I mean an immigration moratorium, sometime around the beginning of the next decade. Now, to show you I've assimilated culturally, I'm going to quote Will Rogers, who nobody in Britain has ever heard of. Will Rogers said, do you all know who Will Rogers is? You're good. You never know nowadays. Will Rogers once said that it's not what people don't know that hurts them, it's what they know that ain't true. And this is preeminently the case with immigration, the immigration debate. To get the most boring thing first, although it preoccupies me as a financial journalist, when I came to look into the technical literature on the economics of immigration, in the early 90s to when I was researching alienation, I was amazed to find that the consensus among labor economists, the consensus is that this great inflow that was triggered by the 1965 Act and the parallel breakdown of the southern border, in aggregate, is not beneficial. It brings no benefit for native-born Americans. It does increase GDP, but virtually all of that is captured by the immigrants themselves. The native-born Americans are simply no better off. Since Alienation came out, I'm happy to say that this my reading of the consensus was confirmed by the National Research Council's 1997 report called The New Americans. It estimated that what they call the immigration surplus was something like $10 billion, utterly trivial in a $5 or $6 trillion economy, and wiped out by the transfer costs, which are very substantial, that is to say, the cost of school and emergency room hospital care and this sort of thing, which are very substantial. In a micro study, the NRC found that the cost to every native-born family in California to the immigrant presence as of 1996 was something like $1,000 a year. Every native-born family is subsidizing the immigrant presence by about $1,000 a year. Essentially, Americans are subsidizing their own displacement. Now, actually, I would say something similar, it may be true, although we don't know because it's not been properly researched, of the last great wave of immigration between 1818 and 1920. It's not clear that that raised the income of native born. Economies are extremely flexible in their use of labor. Essentially, people were always told, particularly by the descendants of those the great wave of immigration, that immigrants built America. But actually, it's more like they got on a rolling bandwagon. The thing was already underway before they arrived. One thing that I also found in when I read the technical literature, and when I looked at which was also in the NLC report, is that although immigration doesn't raise the wealth, the per capita income of the native born, it does cause immense redistribution between the different native born communities, amounting at that point to something like 2% of GDP shifted from labor to capital. That explains the class base of this debate. It's extremely beneficial, immigration, to people who go to country clubs and vote Republican. It's extremely unbeneficial if you're a blue-collar worker. It's particularly unbeneficial for the blacks, the African-Americans. I'm about to publish on VDare an article which shows that black unemployment has actually risen since this recovery started 13 quarters ago. And that's actually what happened with the first Great Wave. The movement of blacks into the northern cities and the northern industry stopped when immigration began. Booker T. Washington was highly aware of this. His famous Atlanta Exposition speech, part of it was about how blacks had to cast down their buckets where they were, and the part we all remember, and acquire technical skills and so on. The other half was a passionate appeal. And it's one of the great speeches of the language, a passionate appeal to whites, and particularly to Southerners, to stop mass immigration. People of foreign strange habits and foreign tongues, he said, because they were displacing blacks. Now, the second thing that people think they know about immigration, which isn't true, I guess Professor Hanson was illustrated it last night. He referred at one point to America being a multiracial nation. Well, there are certainly a lot of races in America, but that's not how the Founding Fathers saw it. They actually forbade the naturalization of blacks. They limited citizenship to free whites. Asians couldn't become citizens until well into this century. There was no substantial non-European immigration until 1965. Maybe it shouldn't have been that way, but it was. It was that way. In other words, the U.S. remained a homogenous nation, well into living memory. John Jay in the Federalist Number 2 wrote this famous passage. He said, "We can make federalism work in this country because we're one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion," and he didn't mean Christianity, he meant Protestantism, "attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs." See, this isn't a theoretical point. It goes to the roots of American order. If you think America is an organic nation that's evolved like every other nation, then you have to be careful about how you introduce people into it, about immigration policy. Whereas if you think it's just a question of taking a credit agreement, just signing on the bottom line, it's a proposition nation, you can be much more relaxed about it. The historical evidence is, to a much larger extent than people realize, that the U.S. is a traditional nation. The third thing that people think they know, which ain't true, is that the U.S. is a nation of immigrants. Of course, all nations are nations of immigrants. There is no known case where people grew out of the ground. What happened in the U.S. is faster than elsewhere, but that raised the possibility that the U.S. was put together faster. They did in 200 years what took in England over 1,000 years. But that raises the prospect that it can be undone just as fast as it was done, that the Union may not hold together if really discordant elements are introduced. There are two specific qualifications to this nation of immigrants idea that I recommend to you. One point is, people think that immigration has existed throughout American history. So if you actually look at the data in Alien Nation, I went to trouble to draw charts of it, it's highly discontinuous. There are floods of immigration followed by long periods where there's no immigration. There are pauses. The most recent pause, of course, was in the middle of the 20th century as a result of the cutoff in the 1920s. Well, there are many other pauses stretching right back into American history. There was a long period of time after the Revolution when there was very little immigration. When the Irish arrived in New England in the 1840s after the potato famine, they were coming into an area, which is where I now live, by the way, where there was no, there had been no immigration for 200 years of any significance. And yet New England had developed enormously through that period, through natural increase. That's why it was such a shock to everybody. These pauses were essential to assimilation. You know, one of the things that that you often get thrown at you, if you get a lot of things thrown at you if an immigration reformer, actually. But one of them is this argument, well, Ben Franklin was worried about the Germans. He said the Germans wouldn't assimilate, and look what happened to them. Of course, in fact, there are German-speaking enclaves in Pennsylvania. But the important thing that happened to the Germans was immigration stopped as a result of the Seven Years' War, which is here called what? French and Indian War. It stopped. It never resumed until the 1840s. So there was a 70-year period there where there was no significant German immigration, and that allowed the assimilation to take place. The result of this is, I may also say, by the way, it's also true quantitatively. We think America was built by immigrants because we live in New York or Los Angeles or something like that, which are heavily immigrant cities, entirely immigrant cities. But the last estimate I've seen when I was researching Alien Nations is that if there'd been no immigration at all after 1790, none at all, the population of the U.S. would still have been about half what it is now through natural increase. It's what you call the founder's effect. In other words, because people are there first and start multiplying, you got compound interest on it. Obviously, this is very hard to believe in New York or Miami or somewhere like that. But I live in the foothills of the Berkshires, in the Litchfield Hills. And in my area, there's a substantial number of blue-collar workers who are colonial stock. My son, Alexander, used to go up at the Tanner Hill on the school bus, stop at Tanner Farm, and a kid came out called Tanner whose family bought the land from the Indians. There's a lot more of this out there than people think. I may say, by the way, that in the public schools of Litchfield County, my children have learned a great deal about Martin Luther King and how awful whites were to blacks. That area of Connecticut was a hotbed of abolitionism. These Connecticut farm boys joined up in vast numbers and died in vast numbers fighting to free the slaves. There's one particular regiment in Litchfield called the Litchfield County's 2nd Connecticut Heavy Artillery, which, despite its name, was an infantry regiment and was shot to pieces at Cold Harbor. The woman who cuts my hair, the man who delivers my mail, had relatives who died in that battle. They're aware of it, but I've never seen any mention of it in the public schools. I've asked teachers about it. I've asked the principals about it. None of them have heard of it. This goes to what we mean by Proposition Nation. You know, maybe these kids are being taught some kind of a creed in the public schools, but what is it? Is it something we approve of? What is a nation? It seems to me the only rational definition is it has to be an ethno-cultural unit. It's not entirely ethnic. Individuals of any race can usually assimilate. But it's not entirely cultural either, as we currently believe. There's a substantial ethnic component of it, which has a consequence that we're not really clear about, but we know they exist. What we face now with the post-1965 wave of immigration is an unprecedented act of social engineering being performed by the government. The government is second-guessing the population on size because Americans of all races have got their population down to just a replacement level now. The population would stabilize absent immigration, but in fact it's projected to go up to 400, maybe 500 million by 2050. And also, of course, we're rapidly shifting the racial balance. In 1960, the U.S. was 90% white. In 2050, by around 2050, whites will be in a minority. It seems to me that it's up to those who favor this to explain why they want to transform America. What did they have against America that existed in 1965? And why don't they explain it to the American people and let's have a democratic debate about it? Why does America have to be transformed? It's the conservative point of view, it seems to me, although you don't find it reflected in the Wall Street Journal or much else, is that if it's not necessary to change, it's necessary not to change. I don't think it's necessary to change the U.S., certainly by as much as it's been changed right now. Solzhenitsyn wrote in his Nobel Prize speech that the disappearance, I'm quoting here, the disappearance of nations would impoverish us no less than if all men had become alike with one personality, one face. Nations are the wealth of mankind, its collective personalities. The very least of them wears its own special colours and bears within itself a special facet of God's design. A remarkable statement for somebody who's brought up a Marxist. It seems to me that the US did reflect, and as it evolved in 1965, did reflect a special facet of God's design, and I want to know why the government wants to monkey around with it. Thank you very much.